This is VOA News. I'm Faith Lapidus. British officials said Sunday they are drawing up plans to target Iran with sanctions for its seizing of a British-flagged oil tanker in the Strait of Hormuz, and it may urge European Union countries to reimpose sanctions that were lifted in 2016 as part of Tehran's agreement to curb its nuclear program. Also on Sunday, new audio recordings were released of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and the Royal Navy both giving instructions to the Stena Impero, with the Iranians ordering the vessel's captain to change course. Meanwhile, Iran said the fate of the tanker depends on the cooperation of its crew with an investigation. A senior official also said all 23 crew members were in good health. Hong Kong police fired tear gas late Sunday to disperse pro-democracy protesters who filled the streets of the territory again. Tens of thousands of people are reported to have demonstrated, calling for democratic reforms and an investigation into complaints of police brutality.
You can see so many people come here on the street and on every weekend, and the government still do not answer for what we ask. So we need to stand for what we want and keep going on. Because we're Hong Kongers, we love our homes, so we need to fight.
Millions have rallied over the past 2 months in an unprecedented show of force against Hong Kong's embattled leader, Carrie Lam. Health officials say an oppressive heat wave that has blanketed large swaths of the United States has contributed to the deaths of at least six people. With warnings of a dangerous heat wave paired with high humidity over the weekend, events were canceled throughout the nation, from festivals and concerts to sporting events. This is VOA News. A gun and suicide bomb attack in northwestern Pakistan has killed at least 10 people, including security personnel, and injured more than 30 others. Salim Riaz, the police chief in the city of Dera Ismail Khan, told reporters a group of four gunmen riding motorcycles Sunday morning opened fire at a security checkpoint in a residential area, killing two policemen. Later, a suicide bomber dressed in a burqa attacked the entrance to the hospital where the victims from the first attack were taken, causing further casualties. The Pakistan Taliban claimed responsibility for the violence in an email sent to VOA. Ukrainians are going to the polls Sunday to cast their ballots in a snap parliamentary election that could consolidate the power of its recently elected president. A tidal wave of popular support in April carried Volodymyr Zelensky, a comedian who played the president on a popular TV show, to Ukraine's highest office. A delegation from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, led by Serene Mabourne, is observing the vote.
We are 62 members from 20 countries different to be all over in Ukraine to observe. At this moment, it's very difficult for us to say if the process is very smooth, because we need to have all the observation in order to give an advice about the process.
Zelensky's party is expected to do well, but may fall short of a majority, forcing it to form a coalition. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's ruling coalition secured a majority in Japan's upper house of parliament in voting on Sunday, according to vote counts by public television and other media. Exit polls indicated Abe could even close in on the supermajority needed to propose constitutional revisions. The 64-year-old Abe is on course to become Japan's longest-serving prime minister. President Trump has resumed his Twitter attack on four Democratic congresswomen. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
Quoting the president on Twitter, "I don't believe the four congresswomen are capable of loving our country." And to echo that, Trump campaign advisor Mercedes Schlapp on ABC's This Week.
"These Democratic presidential candidates are going to have to kiss the ring of the squad, because they are the new voices of the Democrat Party, and that should be concerning."
But Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings isn't worried.
"These are folks and women who love their country, and they work very hard, and they want to move us towards that more perfect union that our founding fathers talked about."
Cummings also spoke on ABC's This Week. Shelley Adler, Washington.
I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Clote has the day off.
Over the last month, we have been trying to create dialogue among the parties because we have the acceptance of the parties. And we're doing it because we have a certain expertise. We are a referee. We are not the player. So we need the willingness of the parties in order to build a dialogue.
Switzerland helps the government of Cameroon negotiate with rebels to end the separatist crisis that has killed more than 2,000 people in Cameroon.
The risk of those people being left behind and not being treated in a proper manner with access not only to rights but also to treatment and care. If we can't talk about that, we will not solve this.
Progress in combating the global HIV/AIDS epidemic is receding. That's according to a UN agency, UNAIDS.
We expect that when it's fully operational, it will reduce the cost of power. We have a good tariff of 8 shillings per kilowatt hour as compared to an average of 13. So once we have this line fully operational, I'm sure the cost of power will reduce.
And Kenya commissions the largest wind farm in Africa. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Switzerland has officially said it is helping the government of Cameroon negotiate with rebels to end the separatist crisis that has killed more than 2,000 people in Cameroon. The Swiss ambassador to Cameroon, Pietro Lazeri, spoke in Yaoundé about attempting reconciliation after more than 20 people were killed within 2 days of fighting in the crisis-stricken regions. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
Pietro Lazeri, Switzerland's ambassador to Cameroon, says his country is mediating the political crisis that has plagued Cameroon's English-speaking northwest and southwest regions since 2016. He says the negotiations are being guided by the Swiss Federal Department of Foreign Affairs.
Over the last month, we have been trying to create dialogue among the parties because we have the acceptance of the parties. And we're doing it because we have a certain expertise. We are a referee. We are not the player. So we need the willingness of the parties in order to build a dialogue.
Separatists say on social media, two meetings already have taken place in Geneva, but no details were given. Lazeri also declined giving details on how far they had gone with negotiations, but said his country, in collaboration with the Geneva-based Center for Humanitarian Dialogue, intend to find a peaceful and lasting solution to the crisis that has been claiming so many lives in the restive English-speaking regions of Cameroon. He said, besides the dialogue, they have been providing humanitarian assistance to the hundreds of thousands affected by the separatist war. The crisis escalated on October 1, 2017, when militant secessionist groups symbolically proclaimed independence from the English-speaking state of Ambazonia. Cameroon President Paul Biya declared war against the separatists in November 2017, calling them terrorists. Biya said he would never negotiate with terrorists who are out to separate his country and that it was his duty to ensure public order, social peace, the unity of the nation, and Cameroon's integrity. In May, Cameroon Prime Minister Joseph John Guté visited the restive English-speaking towns of Bamenda, Boya, and Kumba and said Biya had sent him to tell English speakers that the government is open to dialogue, but that separatists cannot be tolerated because Cameroon is one nation and indivisible. Separatists on social media have maintained they will make the English-speaking regions ungovernable by the central government in Yaoundé until they have their independence. They say they will only negotiate with the government in Yaoundé if it withdraws all of its troops, which they call occupational forces, from the English-speaking regions, insisting the negotiations must be on their terms. William Are, lecturer of peace and conflict studies at the Protestant University of Central Africa, says for successful negotiations to occur and for peace to return, each of the conflicted parties should shift from their original positions.
The conflict parties are still so stiff at the level of their various positions. There is no way we'll be able to resolve this conflict if we are not able to shift from our original position, which we call in conflict management, compromise.
As the Swiss ambassador announced his country was spearheading negotiations, Cameroon's military said at least 20 separatist fighters had been killed in battles in the English-speaking villages of Wainama and Bot and the towns of Jakiri, Kumba and Jinikom. Lieutenant General René-Claude Mecca, Cameroon's defense chief, who visited the English-speaking towns of Boya and Bamenda on Thursday, says they will continue to fight until the fighters are defeated.
Dire que c'est fini. Et nous travaillons justement pour qu'un jour, que j'espère proche.
He says although the military has been scoring huge victories, the war continues to rage. Mecca says he is calling on the population to assist the military by denouncing separatist fighters and providing information about where they are hiding so they can be defeated and for peace to return. The United Nations estimates at least 2,000 people have been killed and more than 530,000 displaced since fighting broke out. It says about 1.3 million people are in need of assistance. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A report issued on the eve of an international AIDS conference in Mexico finds progress in combating the global HIV-AIDS epidemic is receding. The joint UN program on HIV-AIDS, known as UNAIDS, warns the pace of progress in reducing new HIV infections is slowing because nations lack the political will needed to end the scourge. Lisa Schrein reports for VOA from UNAIDS headquarters in Geneva.
UNAIDS' latest global update finds 1.7 million people were newly infected with HIV in 2018 and 770,000 died of AIDS-related illnesses. The report finds more than 23 million people are receiving antiretroviral treatment, but another 15 million are still not receiving this life-saving treatment. UNAIDS Acting Executive Director Gunilla Carlson says the report for the first time shows key populations and their sexual partners account for more than half of all new HIV infections. She notes up to 54% of new infections is being spread by sex workers, drug users, men having sex with men, transgenders, and prisoners. She tells VOA these key populations suffer from stigma and discrimination. Consequently, she says they are not being reached at the scale needed to stop transmission of HIV.
The risk of those people being left behind and not being treated in a proper manner with access not only to rights but also to treatment and care. If we can't talk about that, we will not solve this. And we see in special regions then where this is extra noticeable.
Carlson says new infections have risen by 29% since 2010 in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. During the same period, HIV infections have risen by 10% in the Middle East and North Africa. She says the global HIV/AIDS map shows a mixed picture. She says some progress has been made in Western Europe and North America, though the number of new infections and deaths there remain unacceptably high. As in the past, the report finds the majority of people living with HIV and new infections is in Eastern and Southern Africa. However, it notes interventions in heavily affected South Africa have succeeded in reducing HIV infections by 40%. Carlson warns efforts to bring an end to the HIV/AIDS epidemic will fail without adequate funding. She says available resources to respond to AIDS has fallen by nearly $1 billion. Furthermore, she notes the UN AIDS program is more than $7 billion short of the estimated $26.2 billion needed by 2020. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zimbabwe's ban on foreign currency and the country's soaring inflation have spurred demand for cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin to try to preserve wealth. However, Zimbabwean authorities last year banned banks from processing Bitcoin and cautioned that cryptocurrencies are open to hacking. For VOA, Columbus Mavinga reports from Harare.
For the past 2 years, Dennis Kadengu has been buying as much cryptocurrency as he can afford. He uses Bitcoin to buy and sell online, which he can't do with Zimbabwe's currency, as it is worthless outside the country.
Bitcoin, I think, is the most safest cryptocurrency. And in terms of safety, you can have a large amount of money in equivalent to the fiat, which are the USDs and the euros, having it on your person, moving it around, even in seconds, which is very, very beneficial, rather than carrying a large bag of USDs on person.
Cryptocurrency traders say their business got a boost in June when authorities banned the use of foreign currencies and reissued the Zimbabwe dollar. The currency was abandoned in 2009 after inflation estimated at 500 billion percent made it worthless. Last month, Zimbabwe's inflation rate rose to 175%, raising fears that the days of hyperinflation are on their way back. Confidence Nyirenda is director of Golix Crypto Exchange.
So we've seen a lot of people now are coming to us to say, I want to move X amount of money, or I want to purchase a car in Japan, stuff like that. Yeah, we are accommodating them. So yeah, it's really a huge advantage to our side. I think also it will enhance our business in the long run.
Exchanges like Golix were affected when Zimbabwe last year banned banks from trading cryptocurrency, citing risks, says Nyirenda.
The major issues that they had with the use of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies was people getting scammed, and also they had the fear of money being laundered through Bitcoin. Yeah, so all those issues were their major and primary concerns, but we also had solutions on how to work on that, but they didn't want to accommodate what we were trying to put across on the table as a contribution.
Prosper Chitambara is a senior researcher and economist at the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe. He says authorities are right to be cautious as cryptocurrencies are volatile and unregulated.
So until and unless we have that physical infrastructure and also the regulatory infrastructure to be able to regulate the activities around the digital currency, I think it will be difficult for us to embrace them and for that to have an quite positive spin-offs for the country.
But for investors like Adengu, the benefits of cryptocurrency outweigh the risks, which to them are no worse than the uncertainty of Zimbabwe dollars. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Kenya has commissioned the largest wind farm in Africa, which will improve electricity supply and cut costs by reducing fuel imports used to generate electricity. From Nairobi, VOA's Robin Chama reports.
Speaking to reporters in Nairobi, Kenyan and European officials said the Lake Turkana Wind Power Project is a significant milestone in Kenya's energy sector. Razwan Vazal is the project's executive director.
Based on a rough assessment that Lake Turkana can help reduce power outages by 12.5% and reduce power costs by between 7 to 10% over the next few years, it is estimated that the domino effect will be $332 million in production, $176 million in GDP, and the creation of 54,000 jobs at a national level.
The wind farm sits on 40,000 acres of communal property. It's the largest private investment in Kenya's history, with 365 wind turbines. Fernandez Barasa is the managing director of Kenya Electricity Transmission Company, or KETRACO.
We expect that when it's fully operational, it will reduce the cost of power. We have a good tariff of 8 shillings per kilowatt hour as compared to an average of 13. So once we have this line fully operational, I'm sure the cost of power will reduce. The line will also improve quality and reliability of power. We are going to have a reduction in transmission losses of around 3%. As opposed to 4%.
The 310-megawatt wind farm was connected to the national power grid last October. The European Union, through its lending institution, the European Investment Bank, has financed the project with 200 million euros, or about $225 million. Catherine Collin is the regional director of the European Investment Bank in East Africa.
I think the fact that there is now a more diversified renewable energy mix is a good thing for Kenya. You have the solar, you have the wind, you have geothermal, you have hydro, and all of that, of course, somehow enables less reliance on the more expensive thermal power.
European Union Ambassador to Kenya, Stefano Dijak, called the project a success story in sub-Saharan Africa.
This is the largest wind farm in Africa. And I think this is not by chance that such a huge project comes to life in a country called Kenya, which has managed to reach the best energy mix in the whole of Africa. Kenya is a flag bearer of environmental sustainability.
Electricity from the wind farm is now flowing to the national power grid, but there are challenges, as Barasa explains.
Vandalism has continued to be a threat to this transmission line before and even after commissioning, where people are vandalizing some of the tower members and also those fiber optic cables. But of course, we have some mitigations which we are working very closely with the general public and also the security team to address issues around vandalism.
Colin says the European Investment Bank is supporting a wide range of renewable energy projects in East Africa, including solar, wind, hydro, and geothermal, as well as investing in emerging technologies.
Kenya is clearly the largest portfolio, and at the moment that's the most active one. We have at the moment in the pipeline Ruzizi 3, which is a 140 megawatt hydro power plant on the Ruzizi River, that is the border between Burundi and DRC. That would be a regional project supplying energy to the three countries, DRC, Rwanda, and Burundi.
The European Investment Bank is a leading financier of renewable energy projects worldwide that are expected to develop 38,000 megawatts of generation capacity, producing enough clean energy to supply 45 million households. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Health Organization, UNICEF, and many other international NGOs have long recommended breast milk, not commercial infant formula, for the health of the baby. But until now, the huge economic benefits for society and the family of going natural have not been rigorously measured. VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed health economist Dallin Waters, the lead researcher for Alive and Thrive, a global nutrition initiative who did exactly that in 120 countries. His study expanded on a 2017 report that focused only on Southeast Asia.
Over the last few years, I worked on a research study called The Cost of Not Breastfeeding, which started off in Southeast Asia, but it scaled up to estimate the health and economic consequences of not breastfeeding in over 100 countries around the world.
So what did you find?
At the global level, we found that over 600,000 child deaths per year can be attributed to not breastfeeding according to recommendation. And the economic impact of that level of not breastfeeding is $341 billion per year.
And the figures for sub-Saharan Africa?
The economic impact of not breastfeeding is estimated to be $42 billion in Africa, which is more than 50% of the world's impact of not breastfeeding on child mortality, which translates to about 2.5% of gross national income, which is a huge economic impact.
And the benefits of breastfeeding?
The largest portion of the economic gains from breastfeeding are in terms of productivity through the increases in intelligence in children. And in the long run, that leads to higher economic productivity and earnings for children and families.
And thinking just of family economics for the moment, formula is very expensive.
That's right.
Whereas breast milk is free.
Well, breastfeeding in a sense is often stated as being free, but there are also costs associated with breastfeeding that I should mention. Breastfeeding does take time, and if women are not supported by social protections for maternity, such as paid maternity leave or funding to support the essential caregiving period after a child's birth, it can be very difficult for families to fully commit to breastfeeding. And that kind of reiterates why countries and policymakers and international donors need to invest in supporting an enabling environment for breastfeeding to be successful. That can be done through social policies, counseling, having policies that prevent the coercive marketing tactics of breast milk substitutes like formula, and also the health system supports by giving women access to lactation consultants and counseling so that they can be confident in their breastfeeding.
Why is breastfeeding and breast milk so healthy?
Breastfeeding provides all the essential macronutrients as well as vitamins and micronutrients, many of them that newborns and infants and young children require. And that also limits the amount of negative health impact that can be received from suboptimal water sources or foods that can be unhealthy for infants and young children in the first 6 months especially. And breastfeeding provides complementary nutrition benefits beyond 6 months up to stage two or beyond as well.
What do international health NGOs recommend exactly?
The WHO, UNICEF global guidelines are that newborns should be breastfed within the first hour of life and then breastfed exclusively with no other alternative foods or water or liquids for the first 6 months.
And you're confident that these studies and the recommendations that Alive and Thrive have come up with have or will have an appreciable impact?
Yes, I think so. You know, from our earlier study on the cost of not breastfeeding in Southeast Asia, we saw a number of governments take direct action as a result of this study, which was really exciting. We saw in Indonesia, the government in 2017 invested millions of dollars in a maternal child health nutrition program and cited this study. In Vietnam, they're successful in implementing paid maternity leave directly after this study. And we've received a number of requests from governments already on how to present this material for their advocacy and policy change initiatives.
That was health economist Dallin Waters of Alive and Thrive speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Alive and Thrive has just launched an online interactive tool that helps people in 30 countries calculate the exact economic cost of not breastfeeding. Simply go to aliveandthrive.org/cost-of-not-breastfeeding and take it from there. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, sports. Then a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, and our Sunday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. But first, in Zimbabwe's capital, electricity service is only available overnight. That forces many residents to go to work when they would prefer to be sleeping. Columbus Mavinga stayed up late one night to file this report from Harare.
Most parts of Harare get electricity for only 7 hours per day, and the hours usually come during the overnight when there is less usage and power stations can meet demand. Once the electricity comes on around 10 p.m., Harare lives up to its local title as the city that never sleeps. For the next 5 to 8 hours, businesses that need electricity to function spring to life even on cold, blustery winter nights. Nelson Mujue, who manufactures door and window frames, says he's recovering from a cold he caught while working overnight. He has an appeal to President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government.
If the government can give us electricity during the day, I think we can be able to meet our targets. Because actually we actually getting some orders from clients and we won't be able to meet our targets. Yeah, I've missed a lot of targets and I've got complaints from a lot of clients. They think I'm being slow with my work, but there are some factors affecting us. Of course, they know there are some factors, but they think sometimes the client will think he's lying, he's busy doing something for someone else.
Other business owners say they have tried to use generators so that they can work during the day. But fuel, like many other basic goods in Zimbabwe, is scarce and expensive. This week, President Emmerson Mnangagwa dispatched his energy minister, Fortune Chasi, to negotiate with Mozambique and South Africa to provide more electricity to Zimbabwe. Harare hopes the talks will bear fruit after it paid $10 million in debt to South Africa last month. Chasi says the government can only retire the remaining debt of $70 million to South Africa if citizens pay about $100 million they owe to the country's utility company, the Zimbabwe Electricity Supply Authority, ZESA.
We all need to pay our debts to assure ourselves of power. I also want to make a specific public appeal to commerce and industry. They also owe significant amounts of money, and we would, without power, they can't operate. And when they don't operate, life becomes very difficult for all of us.
While experts say the economic impact of the ongoing power shortage is not clear, they say the moribund economy will suffer even more if the situation is not quickly addressed. Mujua will suffer as well from loss of income and possibly clients, and from the effects of working in the cold and long winter nights. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
And now in Nightline Africa Sports, we begin with the Africa Cup of Nations in Egypt, where Algeria was crowned Africa Cup of Nations champion 2019 for only the second time in its history. Algeria edged past Senegal 1-0 thanks to Baghdadi Bonnejaire's early deflected goal. After going behind, Senegal dominated for the remainder of the match but was unable to find an equalizing goal. Senegal were making only their second appearance in the final since 2002. Meanwhile, the 2021 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying draws was made in Cairo on Thursday ahead of the tournament to be played in Cameroon. Algeria, who met Senegal on Friday in the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations final in Cairo, were drawn to play in Group H alongside three Southern African teams: Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Botswana. Senegal will feature in Group I against Congo Brazzaville, Guinea-Bissau, and Eswatini. Madagascar, whose qualification for the quarterfinals was one of the shocks of the 2019 Cup of Nations, were put in group K with the Ivory Coast, Niger, and Ethiopia. Nigeria will meet fellow West African nations Benin and Sierra Leone, plus Lesotho. Ghana and South Africa are in Group C, and both should qualify at the expense of Sudan and the winners of a preliminary round tie between Mauritius and Sao Tome and Principe. Although automatic qualifiers as hosts, Cameroon will take part to gain competitive match practice, leaving Cape Verde, Mozambique, and Rwanda to contest the other Group F place. Uganda, the strongest of the East African nations at the 2019 tournament, are with Burkina Faso, Malawi, and South Sudan, or the Seychelles, in Group B. The four preliminary ties will be played in October, and the group phase kicks off in November with two rounds. The winners and runners-up will qualify for each group, except in Group F, where Cameroon automatically qualifies as hosts with the highest placed of the other three teams. Still in football, Nigeria's Amaju Pinnick has been dismissed from his role as the vice president of the Confederation of African Football, CAF, and replaced by South Africa's Danny Jordan. Pinnick has served as the first vice president of CAF since July 2018. No reason was given for his removal by CAF president Ahmed, who signed an agreement with FIFA president Gianni Infantino on Thursday to confirm the appointment of FIFA Secretary General Fatima Samora as a general delegate for Africa. Pinnick's exit means the reshuffling of Ahmed's vice presidents, with Constant Omari of DR Congo and Morocco's Fawzi Lecture moving up from second and third vice president respectively. Jordan, who played a key role at the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, the only time the tournament has ever been played on the continent, will now act as third vice president. Samora, meanwhile, will start her role on August 1st. Renewable after 6 months, should both CAF and FIFA agree in the hope of overseeing widespread administration reform in Africa. CAF has been plagued by a series of scandals in recent times. Finally, in boxing, Manny Pacquiao beats Keith Thurman on points to take WBA super welterweight title. Manny Pacquiao became the oldest welterweight champion in history by beating WBA super champion Keith Thurman in a split decision in Las Vegas. Thurman, previously undefeated, had promised to send the 40-year-old Filipino into retirement, but was knocked down in the first round before a thrilling fight went the distance. The 30-year-old had been looking for his 30th straight win. Pacquiao, the world champion at 8 weight divisions, was fighting for the 71st time with only 7 defeats, but with 4 of those losses coming in his past 11 fights before last night's fight with Thurman. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. And now it's time for a Saturday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great music from Africa.
Jérémy Emani, Annie préfère Moussa. Moussa lui en aime une autre. L'affaire lève, tout le monde devient la situation. L'amour nous rend choukou choukou. Tout le monde devient fou. Diaye. Corissé. Ouélé, ouélé. C'est l'amour. Diaye. La situation est devenue conga, conga, eh.
l'affaire est, on devient tous, la solution est, l'amour nous rend choukou choukou. Tout le monde ne comprend plus rien dire. Où elle est, c'est l'amour d'Iaé.
Shut up, my feet, no. some sweet love. Give me sweet love. Sweet. Yeah. Come give me some sweet love. Sweet. Yeah. Give me my love. My love. Come give me some sweet love. Come give me some sweet love.
Doesn't kill you, makes you stronger. Another day, another call. Another day to be a mighty warrior.
Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death,
I fear no evil.
Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death,
I'll be alright.
pa usana epere kwa puta na mende. Yuko opi mganga wako niende. Nataka ni mpeke zawadi kiringe. Ato nilikuwa mtata.
That was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, it was announced that Christine Lagarde, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, would resign effective in September. She was resigning because she had been nominated as the head of the European Central Bank. This announcement reopens the issue about the governance of the Bretton Woods institution. As may be recalled, in 2007, when Mr. Krauss-Kahn of France was to be appointed as managing director of the IMF, many, including the developing countries, raised questions as to why the IMF should always be governed by a European. Under the Bretton Woods institutions, as they were created in Bretton Woods in 1944, it was agreed by the conferees that the president of the World Bank will be an American and the managing director of the IMF should be a European. This may have been understandable at the end of the Second World War, but it was being argued that decades after that, it made no sense. The matter was resolved in a way when the Europeans said that after the term of Mr. Krauss-Kahn, the Europeans would let go and a non-European would be allowed to occupy the head of the IMF. Unfortunately, in 2011, Mr. Krauss-Kahn was forced to resign as the head of the IMF due to an incident in a hotel in New York. The developing countries reminded the Europeans that they had pledged that Mr. Klaus Kahn would be the last European occupying the IMF. But they pushed back and said that they need somebody to complete the term of office of Mr. Klaus Kahn. And they said, by the way, they had a woman candidate who would become the first woman managing director of the IMF. Under those understanding, Ms. Christine Lagarde was appointed. Now, what will happen? The problem is complicated by the fact that only recently the president of the World Bank resigned and the Americans changed the leadership by appointing another American, despite the understanding that there should be changes in the governance of the Bretton Woods institutions. Why that silence? Perhaps owing to the madman theory, many governments were reluctant to open the can of worm and allowed it to go. But that silence may complicate the issue of who should follow Madame Christine Lagarde. The Europeans may say, why didn't you raise the issue when the Americans were appointing another American? So this is a dilemma. Now, the conclusion one should see is that because of this arcane rule created in 1944, many governments have lost confidence in the institutions, not only of the IMF and the World Bank, but many multilateral institutions created after the Second World War. It is not understandable how China and Japan, for example, two economic giants, should not be playing a major role in economic management of the globe. China, in fact, has become totally ready to work outside of the IMF. And they have been creating financial institutions, perhaps to compete with the IMF. So this is the time for many governments in the IMF and the World Bank to rethink their position and to see whether or not the time is not opportune to reconsider the Bretton Woods rules and begin to think of others to provide leadership for the Bretton Woods institutions. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From all of us here at Nightline Africa, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdon, I'm Douglas Impuga, wishing you a very good evening.
This is VOA News. I'm Faith Lapidus.